Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get together here once a week to talk about food, farming, recipes, advice, opinions.
Ranting.
We rant about things. We taste things. We give you advice. And we like to talk about food and local food. Yes, we do. And this is KHOI Community Radio in the beautiful studios on Douglas Avenue, downtown Ames, Iowa. Our thoughts and hearts go out to all the folks in Texas today.
Oh, yeah. This is going to be very difficult.
Hurricane Harvey has hit with a vengeance, and I guess once again, we're going to find out not so much just the magnitude of the hurricane, but the magnitude of the caring of the people that help put the destruction back together. Let's see what we do as a country to help each other out.
Kind of grazing through the news, it looks like the most help is coming from our neighbors and each other. And you know, it's like the government has limited resources, and we, when it comes down to it, we get to help each other. It's pretty amazing to see that part of humanity in action. Thank God.
Priorities. So our thoughts go out to the Harvey victims in Texas, and it is still raining, I hear. The awful, awful hurricane weather down there, we've had unbelievably cool and beautiful summer weather here in the Midwest. It's not really the best for ripening okra or ripening tomatoes, but we have had bounty, summer markets, summer garden, bounty. We've had way too many vegetables, which is how it should be this time of year. I hope you've had a good time eating your vegetables and keep doing that.
And we have to say for those of you that do not regularly go to the farmers market, now is the time. Go Saturday. Yeah. It's amazing. Everything is piled high. It's beautiful. It's delicious. It's lots of fun. It is your, you know, these next few weeks are kind of the annual opportunity to really revel in it.
Find out where your food comes from. Yes, some of it does come out of the ground right here. And there's a lot of farmers markets to visit. So find one. Go there. Talk to folks. Have a good time. You've got a news item for you.
Oh, boy. Okay, this came off of the Practical Farmers of Iowa listserv. Someone posted, very thoughtfully, an article about a very new survey that was done to ascertain the average person's knowledge of food systems and where their food comes from and what all of this stuff means. And lo and behold, here's what they found. Well, I shouldn't have been surprised. I should know. Anyway, so what they found out is that the majority of people in the survey, which was, you know, kind of some average urban area, most of these people did not understand that besides genetically modified foods, all foods contained genes. Everything is made up of genes. Humans, animals, fruits and vegetables. It all has genes, folks. This is our genetic heritage. This is what we have used for breeding for thousands and thousands of years. So when they're talking about genetic modification, okay, we're going to talk about this one more time because this is really, really important to understand. So genetically modified food. Yes, we have been modifying genes for thousands and thousands of years. That's what breeding is.
We have children, too. That
modifies genes as well. If the person whose heritage came from the Ukraine decides that they are going to come to America, they meet a lovely woman from Ireland and they marry, they are mixing their gene pools.
There you go.
Okay. And this is not always about race. I mean, white gene pools come from different places as well as dark and tan and brown and all these kinds of colors. These are genetic variations in skin pigmentation. Okay. This happens in vegetables. This happens in cows. This happens in pigs. This happens in chickens. Everything has genes. So what we're doing in the 21st century, and at the end of the 20th century, is in nature, you cannot breed a pig and a cow together. They have their own distinct gene pools. This does not happen in nature. A tomato and a fish do not cross genetic boundaries, okay? Every single entity, whether it's a plant, a vegetable, a human, a pig, has their own genetic diversity within their species. So the GMO, it's called transgenic modification. You know, so when you hear this propaganda from companies like, this information from companies like Monsanto, who are doing this genetic modification technology, when they say, oh, we've been breeding and crossing genes for thousands of years. Yes, it's true. However, there is a small but very significant difference. In nature, you cannot cross the genetic boundaries of a species. So, for example, genetically modified corn, one of the things that they have done, they have taken genes from a bacterium called a BT, Bacillus thuringiensis or something like that. So they have taken a gene from that and inserted it into the corn genome. Okay, in nature, this does not happen. This has never happened in the human history as far as we know. It's just not possible. But with these new technologies, these transgenic technologies, we as a species, as human brilliances, we can do this now. Now, whether it's a good idea or not a good idea, we still don't really know.
Ah, that's the rub. Whether it's a good idea or not
a good
idea.
Some people think it's a fabulous idea, and others of us would like to be a bit more cautious before we go breaking the boundaries of natural selection.
So this survey that you read about, it's kind of sad that people don't even kind of know this basic stuff. We have decisions to make.
Why are we not learning this in school anymore? I learned it in grade school or at least junior high school or something. The Gregor Mendel story, we all learned that. So I don't know. It's really complicated. And I just want to say once again that what Lana and I are trying to do, what is important to us to do, on this radio show, and it is a voice that we do have, we want to help people understand, learn about where their food comes in, learn how it's grown, how it's where it comes from, how it's transported, how it's manufactured. If you guys have questions, send them into the radio station.
Yes.
Both Lana and I actually have a lot of expertise combined here.
Separately, I'm kind of wiggly, but with Donna Boy, we tackle anything.
Yeah,
here.
But she's the farmer, so she knows a lot of things that I don't know.
So khoiradio@gmail.com will get you to if you want to email.
Right, and we're here for you. We want you all to have as much information and understanding about food. After all, eating is a basic; it's a privilege. We hope that it's a right to food access. We would promote that in our culture. Please ask away. We're all in support of everybody knowing what they're eating, how to cook it, how to read labels, how where to shop. This is the season where nature is, in at least in Iowa, it's really showing off right now.
It is.
It's
and
gorgeous.
Like I said,
it's beautiful.
There's vegetables. There's vegetables all over the place. And like I said, the weather on my farm, the tomatoes and the okra and the really hot peppers, they're okay, but they need a little bit more heat than we've been having. But we've had a lovely year for alliums. Alliums, which is the onion family.
Yes, I understand that at Onion Creek you are up to your elbows in onions.
Yes, we are. And what a nice thing to be up to your elbows in. So we grow a number of different kind of onions at our place, and I like each one of them, and people seem to enjoy them. There's white ones, there's yellow ones, there's red ones.
Say some of the names. They have beautiful names.
Oh, there's Ringmaster, there's Candy, there's Sweet Spanish. There is the Tropea, what people call that the torpedo. Tropea is a long, skinny red one.
Oh, and they're just—they're all delicious,
and it's very mild. There's the Walla Wallas that everybody loves.
Oh, sweet, sweet, yes,
and
beautiful.
Red red wing and red wing and Red River. They look about the same.
Yeah, they're a sweet and, red onion. And there's this one. How do you pronounce that?
Cipollini. Now people look at that. And say, what is that? And it's an onion. It's a flattened Italian market onion. Cipollini. And cipollini actually is just Italian for little onion. There it is.
And you know the little. Do you remember growing up eating creamed onions, Lana?
No.
You didn't do that?
I was probably offered creamed onions. I probably turned my little nose up at them. I don't remember that.
Well, it was a classic of Midwestern tables, and it's the small boiling onions. And in some instances, it would have been something in the cipollini family.
Yeah. Because they are a dense cooking.
Yeah, you peel the little onions. You kind of cut the top and the bottom off, and then you boil them up, and you make a bechamel sauce, really, which is, you know, butter, flour mixed together. Then you add in the milk or cream and then a little salt and pepper. And then you cook the onions in that.
Oh, yum. Very good. Very good.
I might have to go home and do that.
That's good. There's also in that family of onions are leeks. Leeks. And again, that's something that does not look like you'd normally, people look at it and say, what is that? They say.
It's like an overgrown scallion, kind of.
Very long and
tall.
But they come in all different sizes. I brought in a couple medium to little size ones.
And boy, are they beautiful.
They're long. They can get as big as baseball bats, and I'm not kidding. Yes, they can. And they're just as good as the little ones if you want to deal with that much all at once. But we have a recipe on the Donna Lana Kitchen website for leek and apple salad. And although leeks are usually cooked again, sautéed or added to things, leek and onion soup, leeks, the tall green thing with the white stem, there's a recipe on the Donna Lana Kitchen recipe page for leek and apple salad.
Okay, so this is Lana's recipe.
I got this recipe from a farmer's market customer ages ago. There, go for it.
So it's 1 pound of leeks. How many leeks would that be, sort of?
Two big ones or three or four little ones.
And then, of course, you only use the white part.
Yeah.
So you cut off all the green. Here's the problem with leeks that people, they, at the point between the white and the green, there's often some sand in them. So you kind of have to peel them down and fluff them. I cut them off between the green and the white, mm-hmm. and it's a kind of judgment call because some, you know, you want to get as much of the leek as you can, but you don't want the green part usually because it's a little bit chewy, right?
Mm-hmm. It is. But if you're cooking it, the green really is very edible.
Yeah.
But for this salad, you want the white.
For this salad. So you cut it off between the green and the white, and then on the white part, which is what you're going to use, I actually cut an X mm-hmm. in it, about an inch or two down.
Yeah.
And then I fluffle that under the running water, and the sand will just fall out.
Yes.
That's how I clean them.
Because no matter how hard we try to be neat and tidy, you do get dirt around when you
Well, leeks are, they're just famous for that.
Yeah.
How to clean a leak. That's
right.
How you clean a leak.
Anyway.
So you cut the white part, and then 5 or 6 tart apples, and then the juice of 1 lemon, 1/4 cup of chopped walnuts, she says toast them for best taste, and 12 to 14 ounces of sour cream or yogurt, salt, and pepper. So you finely chop the white part of the leeks. You core and dice the apples, and you leave the skin on. So how small are you making the apples when you do this?
Quite small, because this is kind of a mixed-together salad. You want, half-inch, quarter-inch squares.
Okay.
Quite small.
And then the leeks must be cut quite small, too.
Yeah, about the same. Small.
So then you've got toss in the bowl with lemon juice, stir in the nuts, salt, and pepper. Oh, and you put the sour cream in then, too. Everything goes into the bowl.
Yes.
And refrigerate at least 2 hours mm-hmm. before serving. So obviously the lemon juice would settle into the onions and the leeks mm-hmm. and sort of temper them a little mm-hmm. bit. And the flavors kind of all mm-hmm. marry in the bowl, and then you eat it.
There it is. It's a good thing for a potluck, too.
Oh, it sounds really good.
And if you want to find that recipe, go to khoifm.org, find the Donna Lana Kitchen page. There's recipes there, and that one is there, too. I mentioned that leeks are something that people don't know about their genes and GMOs, but people stand in front of my farmer's market stand and they say, what is that? And I say, that's a leek. And they say, what the heck is a leek? And I give them a little talk about what a
that
leek is.
That is L-E-E-K.
Yeah, L-E-E-K. Okay. Yeah, yeah. And I had a really interesting experience a couple weeks ago when leeks were just starting, about 2-3 weeks ago now. Leeks started early for us. Leeks started early August. So there was this nice older gentleman came up. He was wearing overalls, had a twinkle in his eye, and he said, ah, leeks, he said. Oh, so I figured I didn't have to explain to him. He says, he leans into me and he says, so, do you know how to catch a fish with a leek, he says. And I kind of hesitated and I said, sir, I'm from Wisconsin. I know that joke. And both of us, we both broke into this laugh that we shared this joke without even telling it. And considering we're talking about leeks, I will share.
Oh, you're going to tell us the leek joke. Oh, goody.
Here, okay. I'm not
because we're not all from Wisconsin, so we don't all know the leek joke.
Right, right. It's a fisherman joke, and I've heard this now. And I probably won't tell this as good as my cousin Dave up there in Wisconsin, but I'll give it a try. Here goes. Now, this is how to catch a fish with a leek, but it only works for ice fishing, which is why they do it up in Wisconsin,
okay.
Ice fishing. So, you know, out there on the ice, you stand or you're sitting there either on a bucket or you have a little tent over you to be warm. Okay, take 4 or 5 good leeks, depending on how big your hole is. You chop a hole in the ice. And you're out there, you lay the leeks around the hole so they're touching. There you go. And there you're sitting there looking.
So you like have a circle of leeks
around
the hole. Around
the hole. You know, ice fishing. And then, of course, because you're ice fishing in Wisconsin, you reach into your 5-gallon bucket and pull out your 6-pack. You gotta have beer along. And you
cold beer for ice fishing.
And it's on the ice. So you open that can of beer and you pour one whole can of beer down that hole. Huh?
Oh, my.
And then you wait a minute.
Ooh.
You wait. This ice fishing. You got to be patient. And then when the fish comes up to take a leak, you grab them.
Okay.
That's the how to fish with the leak joke.
That's some good old Wisconsin humor. Okay. When the fish comes up to take a leak, you grab them.
Yeah. There you go. And it works too, by golly. Okay. There you go. So it's time to enjoy your vegetables, and it's time to just get out there and visit your farmer's market and have a good time and share a joke, too.
Yeah, I mean, we have to remember that eating seasonally used to be what everyone had to do. So this was the time of year when everything ripened and you had to preserve and store and can and dry and all of those things. Of course, you know, now for us now, you just go buy your strawberries in October at the grocery store. But
yeah,
nature doesn't know that we've changed all of these things, and it still continues to produce by late summer just a bountiful array of goodies.
Bounty, yes. Oh, speaking of vegetables, I had a cucumber experience. I like cucumbers, too. And I ran across something, a beer.
Yes, and we have to remember, beer is a preserving technique,
beer,
right?
That's a
it's
food.
It's an old one. Fermenting, all right.
That's food. I had something called a cucumber kolsch. And I didn't know what that was, but my goodness,
can
it
you
was
spell
good.
That? And K-O-L-C-H, right?
Actually, K-umblotted O-L, well, yeah. S-C-H.
Oh, right. S-C-H.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty German, right?
It is.
It is.
Indeed.
This is Evan, our engineer and beer expert.
See, it's just so lucky. I said, I'm going to have to ask Evan about the cucumber kolsch with the umlaut, okay? So tell us about a kolsch.
Yeah, so kolsch is a beer style that originated approximately a century ago in Cologne, Germany. And it's kind of this straw-colored beer, very light drinking, a lot like a Pilsner, but the hoppiness is a little bit more aggressive.
Oh, it's hoppy? Still, okay, I like a hoppy beer.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a medium hoppiness,
yeah, no,
and it's still noble hops, so it's not like what you think when you've got, like, that really resinous bitter, like American hop kind of taste.
Okay. Hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's a term used usually for hops that are grown in Europe. So you think like the type of hops that you find in German beers, English beers, that sort of thing. But anyway.
So are noble hops, the European variety, are they less bitter?
Yeah, they're typically a lot less bitter. You find more of kind of a almost an earthy note to it, kind of a grass note to it. They're much more mild.
This is a genetic variation. These hops have genes, right? And the European genes are a little bit different than the more resinous, more bitter genes from American hops?
The stuff that you would find typically out west in California, Oregon, Washington,
right.
et cetera.
So,
I mean,
we're talking about genetic diversity.
Yes, we certainly are. And I mean, they're coming up with new hops every year,
They're breeding hops.
They are, yeah, except for I think it's a little bit more organic than what we're talking about with the Monsanto issue.
It's traditional breeding. They're not going cross species here.
Correct.
Hops are still hops.
As far as I know, anyway. At least I hope that's the case. But
yes.
Anyway, back to Kolsch. What makes it kind of interesting, though, is it is initially warm fermented. At about, 55 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit, give or take. So it's initially treated like a typical ale. But then when it's conditioned, so that's the point where the beer becomes carbonated, supposing you're not doing like a forced carbonation method by just kegging it and feeding a bunch of CO2 into the keg. It's actually conditioned at lagering temperatures. So that's like a lot colder. Think like, 20 to 40, that sort of range.
So they drop the temp on it, and that changes the fermentation process, and it starts to make bubbles?
No, it doesn't necessarily change the fermentation process. It's just because the fermentation is already happening at that higher temperature, but when it's conditioned,
it should slow it down, right?
Right, yeah. It does, actually. And
slows down fermentation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, by the point you're conditioning, usually you're pretty much done with fermentation as it is. But the alcohol by volume, though, does end up being relatively low, especially compared to a lot of the high gravity beers that are on the market today.
So you can drink more and not get loaded.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, like usually the style's ABV ranges from about 4.5 to 5.25% percent. So
good.
Ends up being relatively mellow. Now, on the note of the cucumber Kolsch, that is one that I have always I've been fascinated with that for about at least a year. I went on a trip to Asheville, North Carolina, back in 2016, and part of the
that's a
the,
big
Oh, that's
brewing
a, that's a
town.
Huge
yeah.
beer brewing town. I mean, there are like 30 small independent breweries, as well as the new Sierra Nevada and New Belgium facilities out there.
Oh,
but,
my.
I was there for a friend's wedding, and part of the bachelor party experience was visiting several of these breweries. One that we went to was Wicked Weed, which is a beautiful, beautiful tap room that they have out there. But the brew that I tried, they actually had a cucumber Kolsch, and I have been fascinated with that idea ever since because it's very light and easy drinking, and I mean, especially on a hot summer night, it is downright refreshing. I mean, you almost feel like it's a hydrating sort of sense to it, but I actually wondered, like, how would one even brew a cucumber Kolsch? And
what do they do? Drop the cucumber into the barrel?
See, that's probably not the way that I would go about it. Luckily for me, the bride's brother, Bryce Schumann, is an executive chef who's worked at a couple of pretty excellent restaurants in New York City. And we talked about the ways that one might do it. I mean, there's the initial way of like, okay, maybe you would make like a big batch of cucumber water, essentially, and then use that as your the water that you use for your boiling liquid. I mean,
soaking the cucumbers in water and then straining it off.
Yeah, that would be one way of doing it. Okay. Another way, of course, would be treating the cucumber itself the same way that you would when you're putting like specialty grains into a brew, kind of get
macerating it.
Yeah, exactly. Get like a really, really fine kind of mesh bag or like cheesecloth type of bag.
Right, you and get more then, cucumber flavor from
yeah,
them.
Yeah, exactly. And then actually having it sit in the water during the initial part of the boil before you start with like hop additions and stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily know that I would use that as like an additive during the fermentation process itself, the same way that you would with dry hopping. But those were a couple of the ideas that we had when we were chatting about it back about a year ago. So really delicious style, though. And I mean, lots of it was actually kind of a dead style for a little bit post-World
dead
War.
Dead style?
Dead style, yeah. I mean, like a style that wasn't brewed so much. So, I mean, again, this is something that's
not popular at the moment.
Exactly. Uh-huh, yeah, okay. I mean, like, of course, it originated, as far as anyone can tell, in 1906. The term was first officially used in 1918. But then after World War II, you know, a lot of the breweries in Germany were destroyed or devastated or whatever the case may be. So the style kind of died off for a while. So, you know, people just weren't brewing it. People weren't drinking it. Certainly people weren't even very much aware of it here in the United States. That said, with the craft beer revolution that started in 1988, it has had quite a resurgence. I mean, there are actually several locally, well, regionally, I guess, and nationally distributed brands that now have a Kolsch. Examples being Boulevard Brewing Co. out of KC has an American Kolsch. Leinenkugel's out of someplace in Wisconsin has like a beer called Canoe Paddler, which is like a rye Kolsch. Sam Adams has a seasonal that is a Kolsch as well. And I mean, even Tallgrass Brewing Co. out of Manhattan, Kansas has one. So it's coming back.
And so here in town, Lana had the Cucumber Kolsch at... Where'd you have
Arcadia, a fine establishment in Campus Town.
Good beer collection.
And I think it's available here also in downtown Ames, a Kolsch.
Very nice.
Yeah, Gildy says that Old Main has a really good lemon Kolsch.
Yeah, that's right. That's something that Old Main has been doing a lot more of since Corey O'Neill got hired, is experimenting with different styles outside of the typical like five or six flagships that they've had for years and years.
Right. So we've got plenty of Kolsch opportunities in town,
yeah,
apparently.
That's right. I mean, he's done a Kolsch. He's tried his hand at a couple of different Saisons. Word on the street is he is going to be making a rye ale. He's going to be releasing that pretty soon, and it's designed to taste a little bit like a Manhattan cocktail.
So do we have good things to eat and drink here or what? You are listening to KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. We're talking about the bounty of the season. Another thing that is bountiful this time of year at farmers markets in your backyard and in fields all over is sweet corn. We talked to a fine sweet corn man, and he had some things to say about sweet corn. Ray Olson. Joining us today is Ray Olson. I've known Ray for quite a long time. He's a fine fellow. Ray Olson is a farmer and educator. He sells corn. He grows chickens. He's a farmer and educator in the greater Ames area. Pleasant. Tell us about your farm and why do you grow sweet corn?
Sweet corn has always been a challenge, I guess, for me ever since high school. I was starting to grow sweet corn for our family when I was in high school, experimenting with different varieties.
Did you grow up on this farm?
No. I was actually raised in another state.
I'm from Illinois, too.
Oh, okay.
But we don't talk about it very frequently.
We have two defectors. Raising sweet corn, there are a lot of challenges. Sweet corn is different from field corn. And part of it goes back to, and I'm thinking this is early 1900s, when they discovered the SH gene, which is a gene for sugar that differentiates sweet corn from field corn. And then since then, they've been able to, through traditional breeding methods, create some really fantastic varieties. It was in nature. Probably happened through a genetic change. Mm-hmm. Depending on whether it's good or bad, you would call it a defect or a trait.
But there we go.
This just happens naturally. We're talking about genetic modification, but it's the natural kind of genetic modification. A few ears here and there and a few more, and you pick the sweetest ones to save for the seeds, right?
And somebody had to do the tough job of
tasting all that corn.
Tasting all the different corns to find out what they prefer. What sets apart probably the variety I grow is called another, put your thinking cap on, augmented super sweet.
Oh. Basically, how does corn work? We find it this time of year on the back of pickup trucks and at farmers markets, and we all love to eat the stuff. But how does one small seed get to turn into this really handy package sort of thing with green packaging on the outside with fuzzy stuff on the top, and we peel it and we eat it. Or we peel it and we cook and we eat it. How does that happen?
And for those in our radio audience, Lana is looking at an ear of corn with the silk, brown silk on one end. We've got the leaves, the husks.
It's a rather picturesque, perfect piece, isn't it?
If you open up, you can see a few kernels there towards the end. Now, you'll notice this is all...
This is the corn-tearing noise. Shucking. We're all shucks folks.
Notice how well-pollinated. It's clear to the end.
This
has been just an ideal year for growing corn.
Oh.
And a lot of it has
is
to do...
Is that my favorite yellow one?
There are...
Oh, no, that's a... That's
the bicolor.
Peaches and cream. Okay.
Yeah. That's the 277. But this has been, as I mentioned, this has been a great year. There are two things that corn just loves. One is lots of fertilizer. Well, I guess there are three things then. Or, as my friend would say, there's one, fertilizer, two, water, and C, heat.
Oh, boy.
So he couldn't keep his alphabet numbers apart.
So what is the purpose of the silks? It seems to make it rather hard to eat to have all those silky bits in the ear of corn.
Well, part of that, cleaning the corn, that could be a training issue. There are ways that when you're cleaning corn that you can get about 99, 44, 100ths of the silks off.
Just with a fingernail brush.
Why does the corn need the silky bits?
All the parts. Okay, here we get
Here's
into
the parts.
Physiology. Hey, we're even going to talk. I don't know. Do you guys talk about sex?
I think in terms of corn, we can deal with that.
Okay.
I think the FCC allows
it. It's a reproductive issue,
okay.
Right?
So the reproductive parts of the corn are the tassel, which has the pollen.
Way on top of the plant. Way up there.
Which is the male version. And then we have the ovum, which once it's been pollinated, develops into a kernel. So in some ways, when you look at an ear of corn, it really is fascinating that every last one of these kernels that developed had to be pollinated.
Individually.
Oh.
And so these silks, every one of those is a little tube that transfers the pollen down to the ovum or the...
So each kernel has its own silk?
Each kernel has its own silk. Yep.
And guesstimate how many kernels to a good old ear of corn?
Well, most varieties, they talk about rows. Mm-hmm. And for reasons in genetics that we don't have time to deal with today, there will always be an even number of rows. The rows will always be in twos.
Oh, really?
So, for example, it would be 10, 12, 14, 16.
So what do you think this one is? 20?
Well,
18?
2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18. We've got 18 rows.
Okay. I was right on the money.
Yeah.
18 ear
okay,
rows.
Okay. So now, okay, now.
18 by.
Off. Off comes the husks. So,
so this also brings up the theory of how to best eat the corn. I am a right to left, follow each row corn eater when I eat a cob of corn.
She would be. Lana's very organized.
Yes. And now, my husband and we look at each other, they're saying that this is the wrong way to. He just kind of turns it around and takes bites any old place that is handy. So, I don't know.
I think I'm very organized.
Right.
I'm afraid I fall into that category myself.
I am the organized left, right to left. It tastes different left to right. So everybody has their own way of eating corn. What did you come up with numbers here?
Yeah. Okay, so we came up with 18 rows. I counted in German, 30.
About 30.
So we're looking at 540 kernels.
Per ear. Wow. So that's, and if you let this stay on the plant and dry, that would be your seed for next year.
Correct.
Ha-ha.
Yep.
Have you ever done it? Have you ever saved your own seed or?
No. Most of the corn varieties that people grow today are hybrids.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So with hybrids, if you save the seed, you're not going to get...
You'll get something else.
Yeah, you're going
like
to get...
bananas or something.
If you do a Punnett square and it shows all the traits, you're going to have probably 10 or 12 different types of kernels and only a small percentage would be the ones that you like.
Oh, there you go.
So... But there are still some varieties. I guess you could call them heirloom sweet corn, maybe, that would be open pollinated, that is not hybridized. But mm-hmm. it's not as sweet. It's not as tender. It lacks mm-hmm. a lot of the traits that we've really come to enjoy and appreciate.
Well, do you feel there are fashions in corn, like the bicolored corn is highly fashionable now?
Well, it depends on what part of the U.S. you're in.
Well, let's talk Iowa, Illinois, since that's our territory.
I would say the bicolors are probably the most popular now.
Yeah.
I would say the next big thing is going to be the yellow, especially since they've made such progress.
Oh, we get to go back to yellow corn again, right?
Yeah.
Okay, because it was yellow when I was growing up. Then there was, and that was 60-some years ago, and then... they kind of started doing white sweet corn in recent memory. And now bicolor. So we're going to swing back to yellow again.
I think there's a good possibility for that. There's the way I describe my the yellow version that I grow is that it has a cornier flavor.
I think it does. I think it has a more.
Yeah, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. Now, the white corn, I know on the coasts, white corn is the big thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And now the West Coast, the other coast, as some people say, they're starting to go now to the bicolors and being most popular. I have a sister out in Washington State, and that's the big thing out there now. So if there was a way I could ship corn out there that it would arrive in good quality and it would work, she'd love it.
The corn flavor is affected by the temperature and the quality of the soil.
And I suppose it could be the soils.
Yeah. Well, we all like our corn. I'm going to take a little music break here and celebrate another use for corn. This is called Kentucky Whiskey. We're back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. That was a little talk with Ray Olson about sweet corn. Yes, it was.
I just wanted to add that this growing season around Ames, a good number of our local growers have actually planted the transgenic sweet corn variety. So if you're really looking for either the traditional hybrids or the traditional sweet corns, be sure to ask before you buy if it's the GM corn, the transgenic corn, or if it's a traditional hybrid. So you do know what you're getting. We need to be informed consumers.
Yes, we do.
And there's more of it around this year than there was last year. So ask questions. Politely.
Good. Politely. We can be polite. Yes, we can. So one nice thing about a garden is you can experiment and grow things just kind of not off the top seed rack where everybody grows the usual stuff. I've been growing some interesting other things. This time of year, it's hard to grow lettuce. It's hard to grow spinach. But there are other things that are green and that you can use just like spinach. And I have grown something called New Zealand spinach for many, many years. And there it is. It's called Tetragonia is probably the official name, but it is grown in New Zealand.
I'm happy to report.
Yes, discovered in Queen Charlotte Sound, New Zealand by British botanist Sir Joseph Banks, who sailed with Captain Cook's first voyage to the South Pacific. It is not a true spinach, but
it reminds me a little bit of lamb's quarters.
Yeah,
it has a little fuzzy bit to it.
It's not the kind of thing you'd probably want to eat raw. I wouldn't. I mean, but it cooks up beautifully. So if you want something for quiche or something to stir fry, and it takes a long time to get started. The seeds are kind of hard, and it doesn't really come into its own until the hot of summer. So August is a good time for it.
Do you have enough that you're selling this at the market?
No, I don't. But if you talk to me nicely, I give you a bag. Because, yeah.
Aha.
You can either just pick the leaves off. It's kind of a vining plant. Grows on the ground. And it kind of goes off in many directions. Or you can pick the whole stalk.
So you can eat the stem on these.
You can, especially if you're going to be eating it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's New Zealand spinach. Like I said, it has slow germination. So I usually soak the seeds before I plant them. I do that with some other things,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, she has her gardening tricks. I'm trying to learn slowly.
Now, that one, I'm patient, and I do get New Zealand spinach. I've tried this other one for a few years, and I haven't had luck. But this year, I can report that another green spinachy thing that is loves the heat.
Right. Remember, we're supposed to eat our greens, okay?
It's called red Malabar spinach, M-A-L-A-B-A-R, spinach. It grows on a vine.
I'm crunching away. Now, this one is good raw.
That is really good raw. It grows on a vine, so I've planted it on a vine right next to the Trombocino squash. It needs something to climb on. It's long and skinny. The vine itself, the stem, is bright red. It's really pretty.
Oh, it's yummy, too.
And there's... Now, it's not super prolific. I didn't plant a whole lot of them, but it's a vigorous climbing vine. It grows through the summer into the fall. Again, it doesn't really come into its own until midsummer.
And it can take a little frost, a light frost?
No. This one, it's pretty... It's pretty frost sensitive, so be careful. It's easy to keep the...
It's so yummy.
The New Zealand spinach is a bit hardier, and it's easier to cover that up with a blanket or whatever you want. Okay. But anyway, those two things, even if you don't have a garden, they're pretty. You can grow them in a flower bed. New Zealand spinach
just need sun and soil.
Sun and soil, and water. And neither one of them needs any special... They're tough. They're tough plants. They grow in just about any place. And we are in Iowa. Lots of things grow here. So those are the two things I've tried and have success with. And if you're hungry for greens this time of year, that's something. Tetragonia, New Zealand spinach, or red Malabar spinach. Johnny's Seed Catalog has them. And Seed Savers Exchange from Decorah, Iowa, has the seed. Relatively easy to find. Yes, you can. This is KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen. Thank you. That was a fine tune called Music for a Found Harmonium. I do like that little tune. It just kind of takes off, doesn't it? Okay. The Donalana Kitchen News Desk has a small item here I would like to share. It's local news. Tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick.
And Lana saw this herself.
This is I was the roving reporter for this one, believe it or not. And this is a local news item. Last Friday, on the northwest edge of Ames, traffic ground to a halt on North Dakota Avenue. It was long about time when people are going home from work, too, late afternoon, because a very large white swan was walking up and down the road. North Dakota Avenue really was, and this thing was huge. It was a white swan. It looked sort of...
Are they bigger than turkeys?
Oh, much, much. The neck just sticks right up. There was a very concerned young man in a small blue car following with his flashers, waving people around, and the swan didn't seem overly concerned. It was just kind of trucking along, and he was just... And the thing is, this was a small car, but you could see the head of the swan over the car.
Wow.
It was a small car, but and they were just kind of watching the world go by, and it was just kind of looking, and people go by. It wasn't speeding up. It wasn't slowing down. I thought, well, the poor thing got hit. We didn't know. So I asked the young man in the blue car, what's going on? Because I had some business, so I went north to Gilbert for a while and then came back, and it was still there, walking up and down the highway, or up and down this country road there. And
just out for a little stroll.
A stroll. And so he called the county sheriff. The county sheriff showed up, and they kind of herded it into this Iowa State University Beef Research Facility out on North Dakota, northwest of Ames.
Oh, way out there. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
And they kind of herded it into there, thinking maybe it'd be a little bit more at home among some creatures. And so it went in the driveway there for a while and stayed around there for a while. And because it was on the ISU beef farm, it became the concern of the ISU security people who came and kind of watched it for a while. I called. Now, who do you call when you have a swan? Who do you call? Ghostbusters. No. Who do you call? Iowa Wildlife Center. I called Marlene Ersman.
All right.
I called Marlene Ersman. And she couldn't go, but she sent one of her cohorts, or actually who had some experience dealing with trumpeter swans. And that's what this guy was. And a man by the name of Lloyd Krim went out there. He's a volunteer at the Iowa Wildlife Center. And they went to check on it, and they didn't find it. And they didn't find it the next morning. It kind of hung around until it got dark, and nobody saw it. And they weren't too worried. It was odd behavior to see it for that long wandering along the road. There's a time in a swan's
life. It wasn't injured?
No, they looked it over. They looked it over. It wasn't injured. It was just, they probably figured it was a young one looking for a new home. Marlene said they're known as wanderers, and they do. They just kind of glump around for a while. They don't fly for a while, and they'll take off on foot going quite a long ways, especially if they can't get airborne for some reason. I don't know, maybe he was dirty or heavy.
Overweight.
Too much corn. Too much sweet corn. Anyway, we hope it was a young one, and we hope it finally flew off. So that's the news item, the swan sighting northwest of Ames.
Those are the same swans on the ISU pond, right?
I believe so. A trumpeter swan. Yeah. The black face and the black feet.
And where do they go in the winter?
I don't know. I think they have a swan hotel they go to. I know they don't keep them on campus there.
Oh, they just take them somewhere for the
because,
winter.
Yeah, because the pond freezes over.
Okay.
As I understand it. Anyway. Oh, so what's the good word on apples, Don?
Well, here we are. We are at the beginning of apple season. So we're getting all these lovely early apples. I did call Judy Henry out at the Berry Patch. They are up and open for pick your own. They have Honeycrisp, among others. And I think I'll be going out there soon with my grandson because it's a fun thing to do with the family. And we are into apple season. Now, you already preserve some crab apples, right?
Yes. We have a crab apple tree, and it produces these little crab apples that, when they're ripe, they're just something else. And the skin is dark magenta, and when you make the applesauce out of them, It's dark, dark magenta, pink, pink, pink. It sort of looks like a, not a natural food item, but it is. I didn't do anything to the genes
of
this
like
tree.
So it's like psychedelic applesauce.
It is. It's good. And it's really, really tart. My husband and some other folks, some of them are friends really like it just plain. But I think it kind of puckers you up a bit, way too much. So I like to add a little sugar.
And do you, they must be high in pectin. So do you use them for your other jams and jellies,
too? It's a good base for other things. And actually, this year, because I've got so many, so much, I am taking the juice, cooking down the juice, and dripping it through a jelly bag.
And is
and
it
I'm
pink?
Making, pink, pink, pink. I'm making crabapple jelly.
Oh!
And it's pink, pink, pink. And
so
really,
will you have enough to sell it at the farmer's market?
I will have some
crabapple.
I'm going
to want to buy some
crabapple,
of that.
Crabapple jelly is really, really good.
It's really good with pork.
Ah! So good year for crab apples anyway, and let's get out there and explore what kind of other apples.
Yeah,
are
and
there.
I will be making applesauce the same way I already made peach sauce and tomato sauce. I just throw a bunch in the pot, get them cooked till they're nice and soft and mushy. I put them through the food mill.
And
then you have applesauce. And if you want apple butter, you put them in the crock pot and cook them down overnight. So we're ready to go with apple season.
We have to work hard a little bit this time of year, but oh, are we lucky
yeah,
to
those
be
are things worth keeping.
Yep. We are lucky to live in such a wonderful place and have such good food.
And by
to
the way,
eat.
I freeze my tomato sauce, my peach sauce, and my applesauce.
Easy
I,
way. Easy
I am
way
too
to
lazy to can.
Easy way to do it. Well, today on the Donalana Kitchen, we talked about the bounty all around us.
It is happening now.
Oh, yes, yes. The first frost is still a long way off, I hope.
Me too,
so,
I hope.
Get to know a good vegetable and get to know a farmer. Go to a farmer's market and cook, share, eat good food. Thanks for joining us on the Donalana Kitchen today. We meet here every Tuesday at noon, repeated at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, or listen anytime at khoifm.org. Today, we listen to the music, Irish music, by Matt Malloy. We listen to music by Patrick Street. We listen to music by the Freight Hoppers. They played Kentucky Whiskey for us. We'll go out with some more music from the Irish tradition, Kevin Burke, Johnny Cunningham, and Christian Lemaitre, playing a tune called Dion Real to go out. Yes, we will. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had fine engineering and excellent beer information by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.